Good morning, everybody. Welcome to ITE DC2, Module 3. I'm Elise Lonsdale, and in Chapter 3, we're going to start getting into the nitty-gritty of pulling to bits a computer, or assembling one, more to the point. Because we're remote students, there are some audio up on the QCAT website that Grace mentioned before that is accessible, and we would recommend that students listen to that. Today's objectives are to discuss opening the case, to install a power supply, attaching components to the motherboard, and then later on installing that motherboard into a case, installing internal drives, installing drives into external bays, installing adapter cards, and connect the whole thing up, and reattach the side panels, although I invariably wait for the computer to boot before I start putting the side panels back on, and then boot the computer for the first time. So I'm going to start with a quick round robin old question. Who said that? Got somebody in the chat. Was that you, Mark?
Yeah, you're a bit close to your microphone. Just probably back a smidge from it.
Perhaps, sorry. Please. Yep, sure. Now that's right.
Better.
Thank you. Okay, we can be heard? Great, thanks. So there are things we're going to do. So I'm going to start with a bit of a quick round robin. Who has really taken to feeling around the back of their computer case or their PC and sort of getting some idea as to how they might actually take the cover off their computer if they felt needed to do so?
I think you might have to drop your sensitivity down a smidge if you move back. That's the only denser.
Well, that's why I wanted to do this an hour ago. So there we go, because I don't really want to fiddle with it now that I'm in. Okay, so we... Basically, Mark, you were trying to say that you had a... you've had a look at your computer case?
That was Bob who said that.
Oh, sorry, Bob. Yes, Bob. I just didn't quite hear what you said.
Yes, I've had a couple or three different... My older one, the case slid off the chassis, but the newer one, the side panel comes off. So.
Sure, and that's exactly right. Sometimes the cases come off with just a side panel, so you may only have to take one side of the case off if you want to sort of... Yep, usually you've got thumb screws or screws that you can undo the side panel, or in some cases, like Bob mentioned before, you can actually take the whole two sides and the top off together, and that's the sort of U-shape arrangement. So the cases do come a little bit differently from each other, but nonetheless, generally reasonably easy to get into. One such case I've got here, actually you've got to take the top off first, and then you can slide the side panels up, as opposed to sliding them back, which is more or less the norm for most cases. Okay, the first thing to do when assembling a computer is usually you get the case. Now, often here in Australia, the cases are sold with power supplies already in them. But if they're not... Yep, some of the brand... Go ahead, Kerry.
I was going to say, not necessarily. There are actually cases on eyo.com.au that don't sell with power supplies. In fact, they actually say does not include PSU because the hardcore builders actually put in like the Anatec power supply or the Tagen or the 600 watt killer supply. So yes, you can often get them as a bundle, and it is actually often easier to get them as a bundle, but you can actually assemble the cases and power supplies separately if you're building a specialized rig. And I personally tend to buy the cases without the power supplies so that I can put in the really good power supplies.
Yeah, the super one.
Yeah, super duper ones.
Oh, for sure. I actually have a power supply sitting in front of me, and it's actually the one that came with this computer. And essentially it's just a box with a fan in it and a lot of cables coming out the back of it. And the length of cables are usually for everything that the computer runs off. For example, you've got your 20-pin connector and the extra 4-pin connector for the motherboard. You've got connectors for the hard drives, both SATA and PATA connectors. You've also got a Berg connector for the floppy, if you have a floppy in your computer. And in one such power supply I have here has only, because we're in this realm between PATA and SATA at the moment, invariably to switch out PSUs, did you say? Oh, just to change them over.
Can I just make a point here? This is just a case of common courtesy. It might occur to you to type something into chat because it's a thought that's in your head, but can you please try not to interrupt somebody if they're in the middle of a sentence or in the middle of a lecture? It is a bit rude. For us who have text-to-speech on, the chat window basically comes over what the lecturer is trying to say. So perhaps if we could just be a little bit mindful of that. I'm sorry to rouse, but it really is a bit tedious when you're trying to listen to the lecturer and somebody types in the thought of the second into chat.
Thanks, Kerry.
And if you have a blind lecturer and they're trying to talk, it comes over their speakers and we all lose our trains of thought.
Yeah, it's okay, just so you're aware, because you probably don't have your text-to-speech turned on, so you don't get that, or yours isn't talking all the time. So you just be aware of that, because the text-to-speech does blot things out.
Straight into your brain, and goes right into your brain if you've got the headphones on too, like I have. All right, so I was just discussing the power supply is a box, usually with a fan in it, and power connector on the back, and four screw holes on the back, which sort of does relate to the comment. Are they easy to change? Yeah, they're not too hard. They're usually held in by four screws that attach to the back of the case. And make sure you unplug your power supply from everything it's connected to before you go reefing it out of the computer, or you mightn't appreciate it terribly much at all. Okay, so where are we in the notes? Okay, so now that we've put the power supply in, I will stop there and ask if there are any questions before we go talking about discussing the motherboard.
I was just going to point out, there was the chat message did come in early. It's not difficult to switch out and replace new power supplies. You just have to be careful with what you're doing. And I think it would be a fair comment to say that if you've done the cabling correctly in the first place, it will make replacing the power supply much easier if it's a standard PSU. I find it only takes me about 2 to 3 minutes to swap out one power supply for another one. And I think you'd possibly agree with me, at least, that spending a little bit extra money on the power supply, such as the $40 or the $60 version, if you're talking swap meet prices, or the $80 to $100 version, will actually save you from a whole stack of suppliers going over the years. So the more you spend, the better the capacitors, the better the internal components, and often the better the bearings and stuff in the fans.
I've got something else you should definitely spend money on. Your case. Don't buy the cheapest one, because it's made cheaply. Please, I did it. Such a bad idea. It was so hard to get that motherboard in, you would not believe.
Go, Jenny.
Does the motherboard go in before the power supply?
Not generally. They are actually separate. Obviously, the power supply usually goes in the top, or in some cases, the bottom of the case with the BTX. But it doesn't matter whether the motherboard goes in before the power supply. Generally speaking, you can actually install them in any order, or you can actually, but it's important to mount the components on the motherboard before you actually install it, which we'll talk about in a minute, which at least we'll come to in a minute, of course.
Thanks, Kerry. Well, exactly. And in days gone by, often in some of the smaller cases, the parts of the motherboard used to go under the power supply, and it was always, you'd need to be very, very good with your fingers if you wanted to install RAM, because it was invariably under the power supply. So in those days, yes, you might have installed the motherboard first. These days they've designed them a lot nicer. Motherboards are a bit of a different shape and different size, and I think most of the recent computers I've seen, they are well clear of the power supply. As Kerry said, so it doesn't matter so much. But yes, that's exactly what we're up to, is installing components onto the motherboard. Now, can anyone hazard a guess or an educated guess as to what two components you might, or what three components, I guess, you might want to put onto a motherboard before you install a motherboard into the computer?
RAM?
Yep, RAM's one of them. Anybody else?
Chipset?
Not so much the chipset, except for one very important chip in the middle.
Yeah, the important chip in the middle.
Yeah, the CPU, the processor.
CPU, and Mark, would you like to type something into chat? Goes on top of the CPU. No, Mark, so we'll say it, the CPU fan. So we really want to put those things in, and this is because you really don't want to, you want to have a nice, clear, easy to work with workspace. You don't want to be trying to sort of get your hands and maneuver those components into the computer when you've already got the confines of the case built around it. So you need to make sure you're clear and everything's... Go ahead, Kerry.
big reason why you would want to put those components onto the system board before you mount the system board in the case is because when you mount the system board in the case, which we'll talk about soon, there are standoffs and locks that hold the board in place, but there isn't actually anything under certain portions of the board, and if you put too much pressure on the board, it will actually flex and it could possibly break the tracks. So you probably want the board on a flat surface while you're putting the RAM in and clipping the heat sinks and fans on, although the newer heat sinks do have cam levers to actually so that you don't have to actually sort of stand on the screwdriver while you get it to clip over that little sticky out thing on the edge of the CPU socket. If anybody remembers the older Intel and AMD things where you sort of got your two mates with the to lean on the screwdriver so that it would clip over the edge, and then if you were really unlucky, the screwdriver would slip off and slam through the bottom of the board. Not cool, but the newer stuff is a lot better.
Scrolling down, and it says here in the notes to make sure you wear an anti-static wrist strap so that we don't go causing electricity build up, because this is crucial, because at this time you've probably got the CPU ready to install onto the motherboard, and you really don't touch the pins on the CPU. To put the CPU in, it fits into a socket on the motherboard known as a ZIF socket. Can anyone tell me what ZIF stands for?
Zero resistance?
Zero insertion force is absolutely correct. You just do not want to be going down onto that chip because you could bend pins, and it really is a socket that's been designed so that you don't have to use any force at all. If you are finding that you're using force, something's seriously wrong. You need to line the CPU up with the corner out of one corner of it where it lines up, so you know that if you've matched it up correctly, it should simply just drop straight in. Once you've put the CPU in, it's secured onto the motherboard with a locking assembly. So you want to put the locking handle down and make sure it's secure, after which you then can apply the thermal compound. And can anyone tell me why we would want to put thermal compound on top of the CPU?
Doesn't it insulate it?
No, think thermal.
Yeah,
heat.
It allows it to transmit or give off more heat.
Yep, it helps to heat sink the device, heat sink the CPU, as well as having a fan on top of it. Now, there is a note here that says if you're installing a CPU that's previously being used, to clean off the existing thermal compound if it's still there. I think we would do that with isopropyl alcohol, would we not, Kerry?
Sorry, did you ask me something?
Yes, I did. About cleaning off previously used thermal compound if you're actually using a...
Use isopropyl alcohol to clean it off, because otherwise it goes sort of gummy, like really ancient chewing gum. And if you clean it off with isopropyl alcohol, it actually gives you a clean surface to apply the new layer of thermal compound.
Yep, no, that's fair enough. So it's always a good idea to apply a fresh layer of the thermal compound. Yeah, why are my diagrams gone? Here a picture, it's gone. I had here a picture of, just to describe to you, of the fan assembly that fits snugly down over the top of the CPU and usually bolts on with four screws. It also has its own power supply, which it can get from the motherboard, usually by a 4-pin connector that plugs into the motherboard adjacent to the fan and CPU assembly. At this point, does anyone have any questions?
Do motherboards ever come pre-assembled?
Not that I'm aware of. You can get, obviously, pre-assembled computers from a department store that has everything put into them and have been tested and pull it out of the box from one of the branded computers, but I don't know, to be honest.
Actually, there are stores in America that will assemble part of the computer for you. They'll assemble your motherboard for you, and you can do the rest of it.
Right. Well, that's handy to know. Look, chances are, even in Australia, if you went up to a guy here, I know a few who would do it. If you said, look, I'm just a bit dubby about doing this because I'm vision impaired, can you get this bit of the computer assembly done and I'll do the rest, they would.
I think the other thing to keep in mind is that often the assembly cost for people putting computers together is like $30 or $40. Unless you've got a specific reason to do it because you're learning or whatever, if it's all of your new hardware that you've spent hard-earned money on, you'd probably be best paying that assembly fee because often they won't honor
That's
the
right.
warranty if you put it together.
That's just it. So it's really up to up to you, but at least you know what to expect and what you should feel if you pull your computer apart. Because I personally find, you know, changing drives and that sort of stuff a great deal easier. So each one to their own. The next part is the RAM. Of course, RAM is a temporary storage of memory, and also because of accessibility and the reasons that Kerry mentioned before, install. It's a great idea to install that prior to mounting the motherboard in the box. So basically, all you have to do is align the notches with the notch on the RAM module with the notch on the socket where it fits. You usually start with... where's it gone? It said somewhere in the notes as to which slot to use first, but I'd consult
the motherboard different. Manual because it depends on the motherboard.
It had a general rule here somewhere.
Differently. Generally, you start with the ones closer to the power supply, or towards the front. But generally, you need to know what colours the banks are so that you can if you've got two sticks of RAM and you're multi-banking them in the Intel architecture, you can make sure that you put them in the multi-bank thing so that they run in tandem. Otherwise, you'll get an error at post. And I just realised that sentence was a bit too techy, but there you go.
Well, doesn't matter. We'll come to the post. Once you've inserted the memory module, there's usually locking latches on each end of the modules these days. They're a damn sight than what they were 10 years ago. Far easier. Make sure that the side taps have locked down the module and there's nothing touching it. And, of course, repeat these steps for additional RAM modules. Now it's time to install the motherboard. And to install the motherboard, you should use what's known as standoffs, which actually create a space between the motherboard and the actual case. Could anyone give me some idea as to why you would want to have a space between the bottom of the motherboard and the bottom of the case if it's desktop case, or the side of the case if it's a stand-up case?
Airflow for cooling?
That would be one benefactor, but that's not the real reason, actually. Anyone else?
What is the back of the case plate made of, and what is the bottom of the motherboard made of, generally speaking?
It's for insulation.
It is. You don't want the case shorting out on the back.
It's shorting out. Yes, because that would mean bad things, as Kerry might say, TM would happen. So what we do is we install these standoffs, or stilts, I guess you could say, into the computer case. Then we place the motherboard on top of that, carefully lining up the standoffs with the holes on the motherboard. It's been a while since I've done this. Then we want to make sure that the ports on the back, oh, when I say the ports, but the expansion slots on the back of the motherboard actually line up with the spaces left for them in the back of the case, so that later on we can insert graphics cards and other things onto the expansion area. So we line the screw holes with the standoffs as well, that's what I was getting to before, and insert the screws and refer to Grace for her wonderful lecture on how to handle a screwdriver. We can tighten down the motherboard. Go ahead, Kerry.
Not too tight,
no, we don't want to go two turns past stripping and back a couple, do we?
That's right, and the other thing I'd also like to point out is when you're putting the locks into the... because there are locks that screw into the back plate, and then you actually put the motherboard on top of those locks, it's important that you remember to put a washer between the lock and the system board to actually insulate it off.
Yes, good point. The next one...
I'll try to have a couple of those. I'll try to have a couple of those.
The next part the notes go on about, I would have probably gone for the cards next, but anyway, this doesn't probably matter. The notes go on to refer to installing drives. Now, they're talking about installing the HDD first, or the hard drive. Now, has anyone on channel here seen a hard drive? Any of the students seen a hard drive out of a computer?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, essentially hard drive can be slid into one of the bays. We usually put them into the three and a half inch drive bay, or one of the 3.5 inch drive bays. Is usually, in most modern cases, there's at least two of those, probably more in some of the larger cases. They usually slide into the bay, and there's four screws, two on either side, or usually allowance is for more than four screws, but it's a good idea to put two in either side that hold the hard drive in place, because whilst it might sit comfortably in the bay, we don't particularly want it. Now, there's been a number of technicians, myself included, who have neglected to use all four screws, but we won't tell the students that. It can be done. But generally speaking, it's good to anchor those drives as securely as you can get them. Again, as Kerry said, not making it too tight.
Hey, Elise.
Yes. Yes, hello, Jackie.
One thing I was going to say is that one of the things you want to be really careful about is to use short screws on when you anchor that hard drive, because if your screws are too long, you're likely to just go right to the center of it and zap a platter, and that's not a fun thing.
Actually, the interesting point, you should mention that, because actually if you read the specifications of your hard drive, it actually gives you the screw size and it actually says maximum quarter inch depth.
So there you go. So just don't get anything out of that little jar you've got sitting on your desk.
I would actually recommend that rather than having a little jar on your desk, that you get one of those screw organizers so that you can sort the different screws into their different types, so that when you reach into the little compartment, you can pull out the screw that you want. For what you want. We've got a whole stack of them at home, and they're very useful.
It's handy to know. The next part of the notes talk about discussing installing the optical drives, either a CD-ROM or a D-Reader. And basically, if you can install a hard drive, you can pretty much install an optical drive because they're larger. Again, you fit, you slide that into the appropriate bay. Now, with obviously an optical drive, it's an accessible internal part of the computer, which means it will slide those in from the front. I wish this AutoVox would keep up with me. But essentially, what happens is you can actually slide that in from the front, so you don't need to sort of, you know, push it in through the back. Make sure that it lines up nice and flat at the front, so that it doesn't look crooked. There's not a great deal of play in those, and again, put two screws in each side. And anchor it correctly. The notes refer to a floppy drive. Two of my computers here don't actually have those. But if you do have a floppy drive, you can use the alternative 3.5-inch drive bay, usually under the hard drive or somewhere to install that. It's usually accessible from the front door for obvious reasons, same as the CD-ROMs. Have we got any questions while I scroll down?
Some computers these days have USB floppy drives. Some people don't have floppy drives at all. But we've got a couple of computers that still have floppy drives, and they can actually be quite handy because some BIOSes will not flash a BIOS from a USB flash stick. And if you've only got Linux installed on your computer, there is no way you are going to boot Windows to upgrade the BIOS if you can help it.
Oh, yeah, and if you have an older Freedom Scientific note taker, the updates come on floppies, so you better have a floppy drive.
Even with the XP, some of the motherboards, you need to install text-based SATA drivers. And you can use Nlyte to integrate, but you often need a floppy to do that. It's a real pain.
You don't need the floppy to actually do the integration, but if you're going to do it from the F6 method, install extra mass storage drivers to get the AHCI drivers installed, for example, you can actually, as you say, slipstream them in with Nlyte, or you can actually hand embed them if you're clever enough at editing in files, although I just use Nlyte, to be honest. If you haven't looked at Nlyte, it's www.nliteos.com. And it allows you to slipstream in service packs, hotfixes, drivers, and there's a whole stack of update packs on Zable, xable.net, where you can actually get a pack that will actually bring your original Windows XP up to Service Pack 3 with every hotfix and stuff already integrated, so that when you run the installer disk, it just loads the whole box and dice on, and you're up and ready to go. So, yeah, we don't actually cover that in this course, sadly. It's not in there.
No, but there is in Chapter 11 or 12 or somewhere like that, there is an advanced installation of Windows if people can do it. But again, you need a spare computer. I was fortunate enough to be... Oh, a virtual machine, yes, we might even actually set one up on a virtual machine. I actually had as the universe would have it, I actually had the need to build a computer for my auntie at the time. That very same week to install Windows that that we were doing that chapter when I was a student, so I was able to sort of submit a worksheet with exactly what the worksheet wanted, plus my own typically Elise Lonsdale variants to the project, and that was rather handy, that. That's installing with an int file, etc. That's after you've done a standard installation. Back to the notes. We go into installing expansion cards now. Can anyone tell me why we would want to put cards on the back of the computer? There's a lot of different things we can get the computer to do if we give it some...
Oh, all kinds of things. Modem, sound card, video card.
Yes, this lady's on the ball.
Or whatever.
Yes, I remember the dastardly days of ID controller cards. It's usually integrated into the motherboard now. Gaming apps, yep. Video cards, I think Jackie mentioned. We've got sound cards, and in one of my computers I have a TV tuner card. I have seen a radio card, a digital shortwave radio type card that did from AM, FM and a couple of shortwave bands.
Win radio?
That's the one, Win radio. Good grief. I forgot I even owned the thing until now. That was, yes, just going back a bit. There used to be SCSI, well, we still can get SCSI cards for SCSI devices. That would include all sorts of things like scanners. So there you go. Now they obviously sit down. There's a couple of different types of cards you can get now. You used to just have the ISO slots. Now you've got PCI. Now you've got PCIe or PCI Express, which is a much smaller but faster type of card. The graphics cards, particularly the high ones, use the PCIe, which is what I have in mind. Some of the motherboards come these days, many of the motherboards these days come with a graphics already built in, and I'm actually using quite happy with the sound system that's built into this particular motherboard. However, I did want accelerated and much clearer graphics, and I also wanted it digital. So after remembering how different it was to look at the screen with an analog display and having it running probably not quite as nice as I'd like, the very same week I bought this new computer, I was finding myself shopping around for another graphics card. Are there any questions at this point?
Just to mention that gamers tend to use lots of very high quality graphics cards and things. Some people actually have their computers explicitly for games. I generally tend to prefer the game consoles because they tend to be more specialised and look nicer, but there are people who do build gaming rigs and they go for all this hot gear just to be able to get their games running and then a whole lot of fans to cool all their hot gear down so that it doesn't overheat.
And of course, I don't think anyone's mentioned Nick is our queen of acronyms on at the moment.
Yes, she is.
Come on, Leon, what's a NIC stand for?
Network Interface Card.
Well done. And again, many motherboards, like including the one I'm using, so it was one less card I had to put on this computer, has an Atheros inbuilt chipset network card built into it. But yes, you would put a network interface card in there. The notes also refer to two cards for network, also one for wireless. For me, I wouldn't bother with a computer that's actually sitting here in the same office because we've got Ethernet, but you never know. So I would suggest you read through these notes because they certainly go through it in a little bit more detail than what I'm mentioning it here. Essentially, with all of these types of cards, you handle them with care. Make sure you don't go wiping your fingers all over the bottom of them where the terminals are. You gently drop them down into the slot. I usually use the same amount of pressure, do it with two hands, with a finger that sort of hangs down over the card to feel where the slot is, and push it in with pretty much equal force on each hand. Now, be wary with some of the PCI cards. They've usually got a graphics card, so the AGPs were the same too, that had a little hook on the back of the card or on the card that faced the front of the machine, the part of the card that faced the front of the machine. They've got a little securing latch that you may find is spring-loaded or you can move backwards and forwards with your thumb. And that just goes over there's a little hook on the back of the card. Yes, before I was aware of that, I sort of wondered why I couldn't get cards in and out so well until I realised that, yes, I've got to move the hook out. The older cards, the older ISA cards never had that. So once you've seated the card correctly, if it's a PCIe card, just make sure you've moved that little latch back on the front of the card, part of the card that faces the front of the machine, and then you can make sure that the it lines up with the slot on the back of the computer, because obviously you need to be able to plug things into it. So it's not going to be any good if your motherboard's not matched the back of the computer. So make sure that, assuming that is, it should sit all very nicely. You may need to put a little bit of pressure, and well, I say a bit of pressure, but it does have a little bit of play, so you can sort of line the screw up. There's a screw that goes in the top of the card that basically fixes the card to the chassis of the computer, to the case of the computer. So the card's connected to the motherboard, and the top of the card is connected to, is actually anchored to the case, and that sort of stops any movement whatsoever. There have been times when cards can come unseated, even if they're screwed in, not terribly well. I haven't actually seen it happen, but somebody did warn me about that last year when I shipped. It was you? You've seen it happen? And you may have been the person who warned me, or either you or Will warned me, watch out for the cards coming out of the computer when I shipped it to Darwin. Fortunately, we didn't have that problem, so the baggage handlers actually got the computer there quite safely for.
Usually the reason they've got those retaining hooks on a lot of the cards, on the graphics cards, is because they're quite heavy and stuff. You can actually have the end of the card that's furthest away from the bracket actually pop out, and that can be a real pain.
Of course,
if your graphics card pops out on one end when your computer's running, it tends to crash pretty spectacularly.
Well, in actual fact, that's a good point, Kerry, because I noticed I took mine out of the box, and this particular card I've got, it's got some 500 meg of RAM on it and whatever else, and it's got a dirty great big heatsink. It's a pretty high performance card I've got in this new machine, and it weighed a ton compared to what cards do, so good point. Okay, and the notes going about installing the wireless NIC, if you can install any other card, you can install that.
Just a warning about them. Make sure that the aerial can actually stick straight up and down or whatever, and it's not going to hammer into a bit of case or something. I've actually seen some wireless cards that were badly designed in such a way that when the aerial was pointing straight up, it had actually collide with the graphics connectors and stuff, which were often above it.
Good point, Terry. Very good point. Any questions at this point? No, silence is golden. That's good. How are we going for time? Okay, we've got another 20 minutes to go, so we'll see if we can get through this. Next part is cabling, because we've got to get power to these wonderful devices that we've just gone to all the trouble of bolting into the computer. Okay, can anyone has a bit of a reason or a guess as to what things are going to need to be cabled? You might have noticed by this point, if you've had your fingers in the back of your computer, that there's a lot of power cable in there. Usually it comes out of the back of the power supply to a series of Berg and Molex and now SATA connectors, etc. So what do we need to connect up, folks?
Jenny can't get to her mic at the moment.
How are you going there, Jenny?
Power cables to the power supply and data cables to the motherboard.
Yep, well, we usually have the power cables are usually fixed into the power supply, so we usually run, they usually come out in a nicely, the one I've got here in my lap is still quite tied up, actually. Usually a wiring loom, and I think I've got here on one side of it the big 24-pin or 20-pin motherboard connector, which is usually things I would hook up. Then I would hook up I'd probably put the Berg connectors in. In actual fact, it doesn't matter which way we do this. I think they're talking about the power cables first. Yes, they are, because as you said, Bob, there are the data connectors as well for the hard drive and the floppy drive, etc. What else have they got? I'll just have to scroll
out,
down.
Monitor, keyboard, mouse were things that Jenny pointed out. Printer.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to those later. They're the external peripherals.
I was just going to point out, you're saying they're usually hardwired into the power supply. I'm glad you said usually. There are actually power supplies where you actually get to select how many of each cable you want and where in the power supply they're wired in, so you can actually do custom cabling, which is all a bit swish.
Very swish. Well, how about that? Okay, so from chapter one, everybody, can people remember, if we're talking about a PATA hard drive, what connector we would use off the back of our power supply wiring loom would use to plug into the power to the power of our PATA hard drive?
I'll give you a cryptic clue. It digs under. This is for the power. It digs under the ground. It's an animal.
Yep, Molex. I think Mark came back on the chat with Molex. So now these are keyed to go. I think you can force them in the wrong way. Actually, I know people have done it, so you obviously can. Where you really need to know that they're going to, again, it's like anything, if it won't go in properly, don't force it. These things should only really go in the one way, although I've seen people plug in the reverse way and, you know, say bye-bye hard drive. So they are used for the hard drive if it's a standard parallel ATA hard drive. If you're doing a standard parallel ATA optical drive, like most of the CD-ROMs, I do actually have a SATA CD-ROM in this computer, or DVD reader, or whatever you call it. Yes, you would use the BERT connectors. Connectors, I beg your pardon. Molex. Yes, sorry, I'm correcting myself, because that's the next thing I was going to get to. If you've got a floppy drive, you would use the BERT connector.
Just a point here, these are in your test. Bookmark 26 inserted. Okay, these are in your test. Molex, Berg, etc.
Caution, yeah. Do not use... Yeah, sorry, Kerry. Do not
Jenny
use
just
a...
Saying a Berg is smaller than a Molex, that's true.
Jenny is correct, yep. So they usually fit snugly. So I did actually see one a couple of years ago that was loose. And the way I found out about it was when I heard the hard drive go, dong, and I thought, oh dear, we're coming close to losing a hard drive here, guys. Let's turn off the computer and investigate further. So, there you go. They should fit nice and snug. It says here in the notes, don't use a Molex power connector when you're using a SATA power connector. I've never seen a drive that takes both. Are there such things, Kerry?
Yes, there are.
Yep, I've seen one. I had one at one point.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's why it's obviously here in the notes. So if you're
and don't
got a drive
both
that takes
in.
Both in, use one or the other. Now we're up to the data cables, as Bob suggested. Okay, the drives connect to the motherboard using data cables. The part of data cable is usually a flat ribbon cable, and for those people who can see, it usually has a black line down one cable that denotes pin 1. These cables are keyed, so they should not be pushed in the wrong way, although I believe it's been done. So you find that key notch very handy, particularly if you've got low vision. I do. I believe there are some that don't have the key notch on them. Is that right, Kerry?
Quite a lot of the old ones do not have the key notches on them. And in fact, I've actually seen some of the HLD drives, and anybody who knows me will know what that stands for, where they've actually put the IDE connectors on upside down. Some
you
of
can
the
move them
for you drives.
Yes, you can probably sort of plug it in one set of pins too far to the right or something. The next bit of the notes refer to the 7-pin SATA connector for the drives if you're using a SATA drive. They're not
that's in the
exam. 7-pin
SATA.
Yes, 7-pin SATA, guys. 7-pin SATA. 7-pin SATA. There you go. You'll think about that in your sleep now.
Bookmark 26 inserted.
Oh, I thought that would have been bookmark 7. Something with a 7 on the end of it. Yeah. Okay. The next one's the floppy drive, which is... Says plug the floppy drive cable into the floppy drive with pin 1. Pin 1 doing what? Oh, yes, with pin 1 indicator on the cable along with pin 1 indication on the drive. You can actually plug them in reverse, and if you do that, the light will just turn on the floppy drive and nothing much will happen.
I'd beg to differ. If you actually have a disk in the floppy drive when you power it up with the cable in the wrong way, it will actually trash track 0 for you. Been there, done that, got the T-shirt.
Okay, plug the motherboard into the powder cable into the motherboard socket. Obviously, there's a set of sockets on the motherboard these to go into, and they look very similar to what's on the back of the hard drive. Same with the SATA, so... They are, actually. Don't ask me what the colours are.
Red and blue.
Usually the cable is the stripe is red that lines up on both the hard and
right.
The
red,
and
red or black, I think.
Floppy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty.
So you're right, Jackie. I have seen that. Okay. Now we're up for Jenny's external cables to the computer. Now, it does actually say here in the notes, reattach the side panels to the computer. If you want to, you can, but if you've forgotten to connect and you don't hear nice noises at post, you might want to be pulling the case back apart to find out why. So if you're a competent technician, I'm not sure how Cisco would like me saying this, but I have played around with plenty of computers with the sides not on them, with them powered up. But anyway, that's what the notes say, put the side panels on first.
There are some 6800 RPM fans, and if you accidentally stick your hand in the case and get your finger in a 6800 RPM fan, it will take the top of your finger off.
Well, there you go.
And you might touch part of the electrical thing that you might not want to touch.
I've spoken to somebody who had that happen. It just went and took the top of their finger off. And
ouch.
Yeah, just a bit. And they said, I really was thinking of putting fan grills on the tops of my fans to stop that from happening. And after that happening, I really thought it was a good idea.
Oh, absolutely. How much of their finger did they take off? Oh, geez.
Probably a mil or two, just off the top.
It does hurt, you know, and when you can't see what you're doing, it's really, you know, you do have to be kind of careful about it.
Luckily, the slower fans won't tend to take your fingers off. They just bite rather badly, but the high-speed ones...
I have actually touched a slower one, believe you me, to see if it's working.
About the whole thing, I was going to say that the 6800 RPM fans are the ones that go up about that pitch, so they're the ones you get your fingers stuck in.
Well, thanks, Kerry, because I've learned something. If I hear a fan that makes that note, I won't touch it.
Good idea.
Because I rather like my fingers. I'm quite attached to them.
Actually, they're attached to you.
That's right. Okay. All right, so now the notes talk about putting the side back on the cases, and it just basically runs through the fact that the three, you know, sort of some have three sides, some have, you know, two panels, etc. So you will, of course, have known how your case goes back together if you pulled it to bits and put the screws in a nice, safe place so you can find them. Again, don't do what a friend of mine does and work on things on their bed and have people sit on the bed and find out that the screws have gone missing.
Just another thing to be aware of too is I strongly recommend, where possible, to use thumb screws for the outer case screws so that you can just screw them in with your fingers. I actually bought like about 10 bags of the things, and when people's computers come over, they come over with like hex bolts in them and they go home with thumb screws in them, and people go, oh, you gave me some thumb screws, that was really nice of you. And I said, yeah, and guess which schmuck's going to be pulling your computer apart next time? They'll do me a big favour having thumb screws in them.
Oh, thumb screws are great.
Get the metal ones, not the plastic ones.
Oh, absolutely. My case has got metal ones. In actual fact, it was a case of... I got my computer that I didn't actually build most of, but I ended up putting another drive and power supply and card in it. I got this current computer from the swap meet. It's no sooner did it came home, I had a mutual friend of Kerry's and mine with us. He insisted that before I even plugged it in and seen if it even powered up, he wanted to see inside it. So the thumb screws made it very easy.
I can't imagine who that would be. Did he open it up and fill it with blue tack, did he?
Well, him and I opened it up, but we didn't actually fill it with anything. He might be the same student a few years ago that actually said keeping the manuals in the bottom of your tower case isn't a bad idea. I actually generally keep the manuals for my case and motherboard and CPU and junk in there in the motherboard box, which is for as long as I've got any computer. Anyway, back to the notes. It's now time to plug in the external peripherals. Can anyone name some external peripherals to plug in and the types of plugs they may have?
Jenny already did. She said keyboard, monitor, mouse and stuff. And printer and scanner.
And printer and scanner. So
what sort of plugs have they got on?
Yes, let's do that bit.
I think printer is serial, correct?
Can be, but not generally.
Can be, usually parallel. Parallel on their USB. Mouse.
Anyone know what the keyboard and mouse, the older style keyboard and mouse connectors are called? Anyone can answer.
PS2.
That's correct.
Yep, there's nice little round sockets that look exactly. So, for people who want to keep up with the sighted world, they are colour-coded. And the pink one, or purple one I think it is actually, is for the keyboard. And the green one is for the mouse. And Kerry can have the wonderful way of telling us how we remember that.
I don't have a wonderful way of remembering that, to be
honest. I thought you said last year, they think of green cheese. The Mooney's made of green cheese.
Maybe I did.
Yeah, I think you said that. Let's go back and look at a previous lecture.
Probably I did say green cheese. Think of the moon as a moon is made of green cheese. I actually tend to actually use my tongue, which you shouldn't on a job, but your tongue is far more sensitive than your fingers, generally speaking. Often you can feel the embossed icons on the cable. The one that for a keyboard sort of feels like a crosshatch pattern, and the one that is for a mouse feels sort of like a curly shape under your fingers. You can sometimes feel those with your fingers, but even better with your tongue, although we don't advise using your tongue in a work situation.
Ah, exactly. Or ask your friendly neighbourhood sighted person. Okay.
Well, they don't often know what the icons are supposed to look like either sometimes.
No, but you can ask them to tell you the colour.
That's true, although some of them aren't coloured. If you get the really cheap mice and stuff, they're not to the PC99 standard and they're not actually coloured.
Fair enough. Well, I'll try and get through this next bit quickly because we're coming up on closing time. The next bit is the bit where we actually turn on the computer for the first time after you've plugged in the power, obviously. So power is one connector. I'm not sure whether we mentioned before. That's pretty obvious. Goes on the back of the power supply that's sticking out the back. Well, that you can now see that you installed earlier. And you switch on the computer for the first time. And with a bit of luck, you should hear things starting. The computer should make some beeping noises. And it's these beep codes, well, if you've got everything right, should probably only make one beep noise, and that's to tell you that it's all right. Now, this is known as POST. Can anyone tell me what POST stands for?
Power on self-test.
Well, there she goes again. Well done, Geraldine. Well done, Leon. Power on self-test means that the BIOS in the computer will do a check to see what capability the computer has. It will check for a hard drive. Well, firstly, it checks for memory and does a memory check. And you, for sighted people, you particularly on the older computers, can see it count through all the way up to the amount of RAM that you've got.
It's aware of what's... First of all, it tests the CPU, and then it tests the DMA controller, and then it tests the memory. I realise the notes probably say it does the memory first, but I was actually reading through the source code of an XT BIOS the other week. Yeah, I'm pretty sad. And it actually does the memory and the DMA controller and the CPU first, and then it does the memory.
Yep, that's fair enough, Kerry. So it does the memory and it checks to see what graphics card it's got, etc., etc. And the notes actually don't give an order, so that's fine. Now, there's a series of beep codes here mentioned in the exam, in the notes. Now, I think these are reasonably generic ones, but you would need to check. If you heard it do more than one beep, I would consult the manual for their motherboard, because it will probably know what the beep codes are. Yep.
Some new system boards, especially the ones from Asus, ship with a little PC speaker that comes in the box. It's a little piezoelectric speaker on a little wire that's on a sort of a jumper connector with four pins. Do make sure you hook up the PC speaker, otherwise you won't hear the beep codes. Just a little point there.
Okay, one beep in these notes mean one video. So I think my machines here obviously don't have any video on them, so that's interesting. Okay, two beeps according to these notes is memory address failure. Three beeps is memory or bad memory or memory parity error. This is what the four beeps is timer non-operational. But again, consult your book. I won't go through them all.
The important one is one long and three shorts, which happens to be B in Morse code, which means you have no monitor connected. So you usually get. I reckon it's B for blank screen.
Probably. Probably. This is all run by the BIOS, and it stands for Leon. Anyone, what's BIOS stand for?
Basic Input Output System.
Ah, gee, she's good, isn't she? Okay, I'll have to give an acronym question to another student sometime, Leon, but I just thought I couldn't resist. Okay.
We could ask her what laser stands for. No, I'm not that nasty.
No, don't do that. Okay.
Laser. It actually stands for light amplification by stimulated emission of radiation. Okay, we'll check that next week.
Laser. Okay.
Sorry,
Bob, what was that?
I said the way Kerry rattled that off, the comeback should be common spelling, of course.
Absolutely.
All in the notes it says figure 2 shows an example of a BIOS because not sure what you meant to do here. I would probably go in and check the BIOS. And you can usually do that by On most systems, it's pressing the delete key. However, a lot of laptops and a lot of other systems will use other keys. Again, EEE PCs use the F function key 2 for memory. I've been into mine a few times. And you usually press that during the memory test. And it's probably wise to go in and save the BIOS. I mean, so look, I've done a number of factory resets on BIOSes, and the factory defaults are pretty good. And it usually stores that in CMOS.
Just a note here that there is a lab that wants you to go into the BIOS and look at things. If you're vision impaired, we hope you've done it before. Otherwise, we may actually do a pre-recording of what a BIOS looks like and how you get into the BIOS. Or you can actually listen to my podcast on how to install Debian Linux, which I might put up somewhere, that actually has us going into the BIOS and changing the boot order. We talk about what keys we press to get into the BIOS and all that sort of good stuff. If you are desperate and you don't have any other assistance and you happen to have one, you can actually use a KNFB reader to reconfigure your BIOS. But all I can say is you've got to have a lot of time on your hands and be very patient. You end up kicking the walls down by the time you've finished because taking picture is pretty time concerning.
You shouldn't. Unless you really have.
That would take a long time to set up a BIOS on that, wouldn't it?
The other thing you can use if you've got one is an opticon. You can actually read a lot of monitors with opticons.
I've often wondered whether it'd be easier to read an LCD with them now, because I remember the original opticons, you have to be aware of refresh rates and everything with your CRTs.
Yeah, it'll work pretty well with the LCD. There is another card that I'll let people know about because they're very expensive, but they're kind of handy. There's a $300 card called a PC Weasel, and it's a PCI card that you put in place of your video card, and it will actually shovel all of your BIOS output out the serial port on the back of your computer, which you can then hook up to another PC and actually access to configure the BIOS, and then when you're finished, you jam your video card in, and away you go.
Rather handy to know. Very handy to know. Yeah, cool.
No, I don't have one.
So there's a special memory chip that saves the configuration data because this all remembers what your computer's capable of, what hard drive's on there, things like the system date and time and all that sort of stuff. And it's known as a complementary metal oxide semiconductor, CMOS.
I was going to get Leon to do that one, see if she knew it, but you've sidestepped me now.
Now, the CMOS is maintained by a battery, and it's usually a little hearing aid style battery. Do you know the number?
No, it's not a hearing aid stop.
It's a little bigger.
It's bigger. I'm going to say hearing aid. It's flat and round. Round and is silver.
It's a CR2032, generally speaking. Although some motherboards do actually have external connector pins where you can actually put a 6-volt battery source, and you can actually solder up a little connector with four AA alkali batteries and sort of Velcro it to the power supply in some of the older systems. But yeah, it's a 3.3-volt CR2032. Just a point here, you don't have to have one, but if you have one, they're kind of handy. Having a talking multimeter is kind of handy because it's good to be able to test things like voltages on cables and voltages on CMOS batteries and how charged batteries and things are. And Grace posted a link from Blind Bargains a few months back as to where you could get one for about $40 or $50. So I find them quite handy. You might not, but they're kind of cool.
So there it is, and I have seen these batteries go flat, and in the older days, if you noticed your computer was always asking for the date and time in DOS, or a computer coming up at the wrong time, you would know that your CMOS battery had gone flat, and in the advent of newer BIOSes, it would actually rediscover the hard drives every time you switched it on. Will tells me he's seen motherboards that simply won't boot up with a flat CMOS battery. I can't say
I've seen that.
Yeah, it can happen. So if your motherboard doesn't boot up, before you go reefing out the power supply and chucking it wobbly because your motherboard may have died, change the CMOS battery. It might be the quickest and easiest fix.
Also, make sure that there is actually some CMOS clear jumpers. Make sure, I actually saw a board where it actually shipped with the CMOS jumpers set to clear by default, and you actually had to move the pins back to pins 1 and 2 rather than 2 and 3, and it did actually say that on page 1 or 2 of the book, which we ended up reading.
To clear the settings?
It was automatically set to 2 and 3, 2 and 3, which is clear CMOS, and it was set that way by default.
Oh, good on them. So every time... Oh, brilliant. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the end of the lecture. And it's time for the quiz when we're ready. Does anyone have any questions up to this point.
I have one comment.
Cable, how many pins are in a pot of cable?
40 pins, 40. 80 wires.
Roger, roger.
Okay, so there you go. And how many
Grace
has started,
Grace
guys?
Has a comment.
Okay, for the labs, look through all of the labs, but in three. Some of the labs, you do not need to fill anything in for them, so you do not need to send some of them in because there is nothing to fill in.
Yeah, they're read-only worksheets. We like those ones because we don't have to mark them.
Yeah, so read-only, ROM worksheets, good, RAM worksheets, you know, read-only worksheets.
But cool. There's some that you do have to fill in. So just read through them all and make sure there's nothing you need to write down.
Wise idea to read them.
Just a point, the worksheets are actually part of the mark. 15% of your mark is the worksheets. And if you don't do any worksheets, we will not pass you. You fail. Epically, perhaps?
Yeah, Ian and I were setting all that up the other day, so your worksheets do account for stuff. And we have seen some great work come back from some of our students already, so thank you for doing that. And
that's good. And look, thank I'd you. Suggest that you sort of chip away at the worksheets as the modules are fresh in your head. Don't put them off until the end. You can do that, but it'll just make it harder for yourself.
And try and pre-read your chapter notes before we come on for lecture two, because sometimes that you can raise the questions through the actual relevant. It is time for question one. We're going to have a 9-question quiz today, because it's what looks like Geraldine sent to me in the notes. So we are going to begin when everyone's ready. If everyone can move over to their chat screens. Okay, question one of our quiz. A technician is installing a new power supply in a computer. Which type of power connector should be used for the CD-ROM? Option A is Berg. Option B is Mini Molex. Option C is Molex. And option D is 20-pin ATX connector. We got three answers. How many answers are we looking for? Who's on channel today? For the people who got C, which I think everyone has answered, you are correct. Okay, a technician is installing a new power supply into a computer. Which type of connector should be used for the motherboard? Option A. Sorry, Kerry.
I'm just going to say, are they all the same order as last time, or are you going to go read through the options again?
Better read through them again, because A, people may not remember, and B, they don't appear to be in order. Okay, so we're connecting the motherboard up, so what type of power connector do we want? Option A is a Berg. Option B is a Mini Molex. Option C is a Molex. Oh, yeah, they are in order, sorry. And option D is a 20-pin, I haven't got to it yet, guys. Option D is a 20-pin connector. Yeah, option D for the motherboard.
In the words of Daily Special, if you said D, good for you.
Exactly. If you said D, good for you. Okay, question three, when installing a CPU, which items will maintain even contact and heat distribution between the CPU and the heatsink? Option A, silicon spray. Option B, graphite paste. Option C, I love this one, glue. And option D is thermal compound.
Oh, it's totally glue, you guys.
For those who said option D, which was everybody, you are correct. Go ahead, Kerry.
No, that's okay. I was just about to say, yeah, option D is correct. that'd be cool.
Oh yeah, I'd love to see the computer be turned on with that on it.
Okay, this one could be hard for me to read, but I'll try it. Okay. When installing a CPU into a ZIF socket, how should the technician align the pins to avoid damage? Pin 1 is always aligned with the opposite pin. Hang on. Pin line is always aligned with the opposite corner from the base. That's option A. Pin 1 of the CPU is aligned with, this is option B, pin 1 of the CPU is aligned with pin 1 on the ZIF socket. Option C, pin 1 is aligned with the corner closest to the memory. The removed corner of the CPU is always aligned with the corner opposite from pin 1. Yep. Any other takers?
I have a comment.
Well, well done for even understanding what I said. Yes, the answer is B, and you are all correct. Go ahead, Grace.
A really good way to tell, to line it up, is a lot of the CPUs do have that cutout corner, and you can line the cut-up corner with the other cutout corner, and there you go for us blind people, because we cannot see pin 1.
Mm-hmm.
I have seen CPUs, though the modern ones don't tend to, but older ones will go in every orientation. So be warned, you only make a mistake once and it goes bang. And sometimes it can be difficult to feel the cut-up corners, especially if somebody's been belting around the CPU with a screwdriver and chip bits out of the corners. But if you have a new CPU, that's certainly a good way to do it. Or a CPU that hasn't been belted around with a screwdriver, which of course all of yours wouldn't be because you've read ITE 1 Chapter 2.
It's not foolproof. Some don't have the cutout corners, but a lot of them do now. So,
also be warned that with the socket 775, the pins are actually in the socket, not on the CPU. It is possible to install them, but you do have to be very careful because you can actually bend a row of pins out on one side. And we have a mutual friend, not the same one that that opened up Elisa's computer, a different mutual friend who actually did bend out a whole row of pins on a socket 775 because they weren't careful enough when dropping the CPU into the socket.
Mm-hmm. Okay. RAM. We love RAM, particularly if you're running Windows.
You need quite a bit of
it
now.
You do, don't you? A technician is installing additional RAM into a computer. How can the technician guarantee that the memory is correctly aligned? Option A. The label on the memory module should always face the CPU. Then a notch in the memory the notch in the memory module should be aligned with a notch in the slot. The arrows on the memory module should be aligned with the arrows on the motherboard slot. That's option D. Option D. Somebody's taken my numbers away. Option D. All memory motherboard slots are coded with color codes, one end red and one end blue. Answers in we've got a couple of answers in already. Don't know. Okay, that's fine. We'll find out when we finish the answers. Okay, for all of you who answered B, you are correct. It is, for the person who doesn't know, a notch in the memory module should be aligned with a notch in the slot. Again, if you've got good manual dexterity, you are able to feel that as a vision impaired person.
And that was covered in the first part of today's lecture. In case you want to revise that, I'll just say that you know where it is.
Something else that was covered in earlier part of today's lecture is when mounting a motherboard in a computer case, what is used to prevent the motherboard from touching the bottom of the case? Option A, standoffs. Option B, wait for the options, please, guys.
I think we all want to get it over with.
Okay, option A it is. Forget the rest. Silicon spray, I don't know why you'd spray it. Grounding straps, and we can forget that.
Yeah, they'll know it if they all said A.
Hey, what do you mean? Well, I think it's standoffs, eh? That's not that saying in Queensland. Okay. This is an interesting question here. When installing multiple drives, what is the name given to the middle drive, which is attached to the middle connector on a PATA cable? In other words, we've got two drives, and this is the one in the middle between the one end of the cable and the motherboard, basically. Option A is secondary drive. Option B is master drive. Option C is middle drive. Option D is redundant drive. And option E is slave drive.
Loaded question.
The correct answer is E, the slave drive.
Slave, yes.
But it's not always.
Yes, it is. When you pull a drive out of its default packet, it is jumpered for cable select unless you override it. Therefore, cable position defines what setting it will get. And what you will find is that when you pull a default parter drives out, they are always jumpered for cable select for easy plug-and-play installation on colour-coded cables, because all of the manuals tell you that you put this drive on the blue one and this one on the red one, and the cable select makes that happen automatically.
Yeah, but yes, if it's not a new drive, then it's not going to...
All of the old drives default to being jumpered as cable select as well, and back through 1995. It is actually possible that they usually are default jumpered for cable select. Yes, I agree, you can and should override it, and you should explicitly jumper the drives for master and slave if setting up parter drives, and that's exactly what I do, but they are working on the default assumption, sadly, and the default is for cable select, and the middle drive is slave.
Okay, question 8, second last question, gang. When installing adapter cards in a computer, how should a technician secure the card? Option A, install the card and attach it to the case using thermal paste. Option B, install the card and attach it to the motherboard using thermal pads. Okay, install it. Option C, install the card and secure the card by using metal retaining strips into the slot. Okay, option D is install a card and secure it to the case with a screw. Vote now. Got one answer. We have one answer, two answers. Okay. Those who got D are correct. Remember how we talked about the card, lining the card up at the back of the case so we can plug in our peripherals. On the top of the card, there's usually a screw that anchors the top of the card to the case. Last question, gang, and that is, which two connectors are used to connect external peripherals? A, IDE connector. B, Molex connector. C, Parter connector. D, PS2 connector. And E, USB connector. Choose two. Yeah, we're thinking external devices, so... Yep, got one correct answer, one half correct answer. Keep coming. All right, well, I'll answer it for you because it's almost time to go home. The answer for external connectors...
D and E was actually the correct answer as well. So
yes, PS2.
She did get it right.
Yes, okay. I only heard a D out of somebody. I heard a D and an E, which are, of course, PS2 and USB connectors. Ladies and gentlemen, here endeth the lecture.